So when Lauren and I were chatting about the role that I might play kicking off this panel, we decided that my charge would be to talk a little bit about what's the future of water going to look like over the next 30, 40, 50 years, broad brush, and what are some of the peace and conflict dimensions and ramifications of that. So when I think about how we'll manage water differently 30, 40, 50 years from now, I see three big trends coming. We'll be storing a lot more water. We'll be recycling a lot more water, and we'll be thinking much more systematically and foundationally about flood risk. I don't think those are the only things we'll be doing. I certainly hope not. I hope we'll be thinking smart about ecosystems. I hope we think we'll be pricing water appropriately, et cetera. I hope we'll be bringing water justice to the 1 billion people who still don't have a secure supply of drinking water and the 2 billion who don't have a sanitation system of the sort that Claudius built in the Roman Empire 2,000 years ago. But I am quite confident that we'll be storing more, recycling more, and manage and floodproofing more. Storing water to smooth out extremes, to buffer against shortages, and also to replace the natural storage that we're losing as snowpack and ice melt start to go away in a greenhouse world. Recycling more water to enhance supplies, and also to reduce the energy and conservation costs of our current water system. We clean water to world-class drinking standards. We use a large amount of energy to pump it to your toilet. And if your toilet is more than 20 years old, with two flushes of that to make a few ounces of urine go away, you've just flushed away what the World Health Organization says is the daily survivable minimum of water for immediate personal use. That is not a smart system, and that's going to start to change. It's changing already, obviously. And third, I think we'll be thinking more actively about flood risks, particularly this sort of double exposure that coastal cities and towns face, where on the one hand, they're exposed from the storms, the intensifying storms we're seeing from the sea, higher sea level, water, sea temperature, et cetera, but also at danger from flash flooding from the heavy rainfalls. And this, in fact, was what hit Houston with Harvey. It wasn't just the coastal exposure. It was in particular the heavy, heavy rains that stalled over the city, and therefore inundated. Why will we be doing these things? Well, it's obvious climate change is obviously one of the drivers, and it's interesting that we're meeting here today just in the wake of the fourth National Climate Assessment Report, and the water chapter of that, I think, is required reading for all of us. But the key point is it's not just climate change, right? This is also, I think, a reasonable projection of the trends we're seeing in water supply and water demand, the shifts we're seeing in the economics of water, the state of our existing infrastructure, our aging infrastructure that will have to be replaced, hopefully not replicated, but replaced, and the fact that a growing cast of actors from the Pentagon to large companies worried about their supply chains to municipalities are taking actions to manage their exposure and the real water risks that they face. And all of those adaptations, storing more water to smooth out the curves, recycling more water to enhance the supplies, and thinking smart about floods, can be seen as that adaptive adjustments in that regard. How will we do it? Well, legal and administrative systems will change. We're going to be pricing water differently. We'll be zoning differently. We'll be doing project planning, design, and impact assessment differently. Financing, we're seeing it change before our eyes. The bond market references that were made earlier are instructive in that regard. Investment, insurance schemes, managing financial risk. But we're also going to be doing it with infrastructure. And that's I think one of the really key points. We have to get the infrastructure decisions right. And the reason for that, number one, is infrastructure is long-lived. You heard the number 300 years being tossed out earlier, the quote from the World Bank about how long. Now, I'm not sure most of what the World Bank builds actually does last 300 years, but nonetheless, we're talking many, many, many decades out, and that's a real planning challenge. There's also a very large social and ecological impact, second-order consequences, unintended consequences of the infrastructure choices that we made, and that's the link to the peace and conflict dimension that we'll have to pay attention to as well. So on the one hand, at the aggregate social level, from 30,000 feet, you can see all of those big, broad trends, as positive adaptations, right, in the search for resilience, in the search for risk management. And I very much believe that to be true. It's also the case, though, that they are laden with tremendous potential for injustice, for inequality, for contentiousness, and for conflict, violent or otherwise, right? On water storage, storing more water, we know very well the contentiousness that goes with the history of large dam projects, environmental consequences, human rights consequences, and I won't belabor the point. On water recycling, it was interesting when Chris Holmes made a reference that I very much agree with about what was going on in the Middle East. I hope people caught the implication of his comment that that's not simply recycling water, that's reallocating water from one use to another use. You know, we've all been places in the world, I know there's a lot of people in this room that get out on the road quite a lot, we've all been places in the world where you observe agriculture in progress and you see the quality of the water that's being used for that and you say, oh, I'm never eating a pineapple again, or I'm never eating an olive again. But that is that water, even that very poor quality water, even that wastewater, that's a livelihood resource for somebody. And so you close the loop on that, you start recycling that, you are changing somebody's livelihood chances and outcomes, and that's likely to be highly contentious as well. And on flood risk, the question of how we redesign our landscapes, right, our waterscapes, is inseparable from questions of property values, from the integrity and history of neighborhoods, from communities' ways of life. There's a fair bit of contention locked up in that as well. So the key message that I'd like to stress is that it's not enough to capture the macro benefits to society of these broad adjustments that we know are coming and that we know make sense writ large. We have to manage the micro considerations. Who wins? Who loses? Whose voice? How do we spot the unintended consequences? How do we spot the second order effects? Because for many people, those second order and unintended effects, that's the real story, not the water adjustment that your smart project is, in fact, trying to implement. There's some tools we need to have that conversation more intelligently. And I think we've heard a lot about this today. And so I'll just simply name three things that are very much on my mind. And I think the examples have been sprinkled across the day. We have to move from when we negotiate, we have to move from the concept that we are negotiating a fixed solution to a problem to the idea that we're engaged in an ongoing conversation. There's no end point to this. There's no solution. We can't possibly know how many times we're going to have to come back to that agreement over the 300 years, or maybe more reasonably, the 70 or 80 year life cycle of that piece of water infrastructure. Really interesting trend in international law. If you just study treaties over the last 100 years, treaties are becoming much more flexible instruments than they were previously. In the old days of countries signing treaties that bound their hands, now we have conference of the parties, we have sunset provisions, we have revisiting things. It's becoming a more flexible and a more dynamic instrument. So, someone asked the question this morning, when do we trust the engineers too much? When do we trust them too little? Well, I have very complicated views about that. Some of my best friends are engineers. But you know, conflict sensitivity has to become a course in civil engineering programs. I think you know where I'm going with that, right? Again, somebody's solution always has second-order consequences, always has unintended consequences. For a majority of the people who are stakeholders around that implemented solution, those are the real ramifications of the project. And we have to pay attention to that. So as we get climate smart, we also have to get conflict smart and equity smart. And the third point that I would make is we have to figure out how do we quantify the value of flexibility. Imagine that you're trying to generate 1,000 megawatts of electricity by building a large hydroelectric dam or a cascade of dams or something like that. Well, in the old days of stationarity and relative predictability, I'm not sure this was ever true, but I'll tell a story about a kind of a mythical, simpler time when this was maybe plausibly true. Economies of scale would probably rule, and it would make sense to build one big pile of concrete and generate 1,000 megawatts in one project, rather than 100 megawatts in 10 projects, or 10 megawatts in 100 projects, or 1 megawatt in 1,000 projects. Well, if that project is going to have a 70-year life cycle, there are seven or eight parameters that, looking backwards 70 years down the road, will dictate whether that was a socially profitable sort of economics, but in a kind of a broad social sense, not a narrow financial sense. What's the price of water going to be for the next 70 years? What's the opportunity cost of using the land that way instead of growing food? How much protest and delay will there be in bringing this project online? What are interest rates going to do over the next 70 years? For goodness sake, we still cost environmental regulations using discount rates of 3% and 7%, and we reject regulations that don't meet that standard when we've just come through a decade of negative real interest rates. We don't know what the future is going to entail. Under those circumstances, at some point, economies of scale still exist, but there are enormous diseconomies of scale. What are the odds that you're going to put that one pile of concrete in just the right place? And economies of flexibility start to become a real thing. And they become a real thing for two very different reasons. First, there is a value that we can price in delaying a decision until you have more information. And second, there's a value in being able to change your mind. And so rather than building that 1,000 megawatt project, we build a few for a few years. We change our mind. We adapt. We adjust. And at some point, as the uncertainty becomes more and more and more at your initial vantage point, those economies of flexibility can start to compete with and possibly even outweigh the economies of scale that we've thought about. So that's another tool. How to price that, how to measure the cost we're paying for inflexibility and the value we're purchasing through flexibility. So that's the 30,000-foot perspective that I take when I think about water over the next 30, 40, 50 years.